Blog Talk Radio.
Desert. We're speaking hope and freedom to Iran here. Welcome, Internet World, the music of Striper, the battle hymn of the Republic, reminding me what a great nation this is, the United States of America, the greatest bastion for democracy and freedom in this world. And guess what? I don't apologize for my nation. I don't apologize for my country, and neither should you. Welcome to the Cross in the Desert. We have a very incredible program for you today. We're going to get right to it. Just in this first half an hour, we're going to dedicate to the oppressed women from the film Honor Diaries, the documentary that talks about female genital mutilation, honor killings, and forced marriages. I want to talk to you today a little bit about that in light of what's happening in the world and in light of what I'm starting to write now. I just began book number 10 this week. It's called Prisoner of Her Culture, Sakina's Fight for Freedom, which is just about this subject of forced marriage. And I'm really excited about this new book that takes place in part in Pakistan and also in the United States. I'm always excited to write and to be a voice for the oppressed women all around the world. And I want to remind us all before we get started with the normal trend of things, I want us to pause and reflect on what today, Thursday, April 16th, means. It is National International Holocaust Remembrance Day. And the sirens went off in Israel earlier this morning during their time. We think back to the atrocities, the systematic genocide, if you will, of the Jewish race more than 70 years ago. And we think back to the people that were systematically murdered by the racist German army through so many ways, asphyxiation by gas, the gas chambers, just an event we can never ever forget. We must keep in mind that we never repeat history. But since I'm talking about the Holocaust 70 years ago, I want to remind us there is another Holocaust taking place at the other side of the world in Iraq among the Assyrian Christians with ISIS and the Iraqi government. And later on in the second half hour of our program, I'm going to have back my very special friend Naureen and Weya to update us on what has happened. This is one of the most horrible crimes of the century that's going on. And we must do something to change the strategy that's going on in Iraq, to curb what is happening. We must protect and keep our Syrian Christians in prayer and prepare a safe haven for their existence. They are being eradicated and killed by ISIS, and because of the failure of the Iraqi government, it's putting this entire race of Assyrian Christians in very, very difficult harm's way. We will talk to Naureen at the 10 o'clock hour. You don't want to miss this interview to be informed, to be educated, so that you can act and be a voice for the Assyrian Christians that are suffering so much. I mentioned to you we're going to talk this morning on the first half an hour about forced marriages. In the U.S., honor violence is a crime that goes unnoticed and unrecognized. Women and girls are beaten, burned with acid, and murdered right under our noses, but it is all too often overlooked. Now, Honor Diaries has put together a campaign to spread awareness about these human rights atrocities, and it's based on their award-winning documentary film, Honor Diaries. And now Honor Diaries has sent out a memo, and I've got this on my page, a petition for you to sign. They've sent out a memo. They are teaming up with one of the people, one of the persons in the film, Jasvinder Sanghala. She has an organization called Kamar Nirvana. It's an intervention organization against forced marriage that steps into the situation to really bring help. And what they're doing is, in the UK, in fact, they have a day set aside, a memorial day to honor the victims. And what Jasvinder is doing, she's coming here to the U.S. She's here, actually, and she's campaigning awareness for forced marriage. And she wants the United States, and I'm all for this, to create a special National Day of Memory on July 14th. To remember the victims of honor crimes. And you'll see a petition on my Facebook page that you can sign. I think this is a great, great cause. A family can feel that their honor is tarnished by their daughter acting or dressing too Western, having rumors spread about her, refusing to participate in a forced marriage, and as we've sadly seen, even for merely looking for a boy or looking at a boy. Contrary to popular belief, honor violence does not just happen over there, overseas. In the past several years alone, we have seen honor killings here in the United States that make the news and just literally shock the nation. According to a report by Phyllis Chesler, there are 33 known victims that have been murdered for honor in North America. And I'm going to mention some names you probably know. Right here where I live, St. Louis, 16-year-old Pakistani girl Tina Issa was married by her Palestinian father, murdered by her Palestinian father with the aid of his wife. Her parents were dissatisfied with her westernized lifestyle. Amin and Sarah Said, two teenagers from Texas, you remember this story, her horrible story, were killed allegedly by their Egyptian father, who is still at large, again, because they were dating American boys, non-Muslim boys, and were being too westernized in their appearance. And I could go on and on. I think you get the idea of what's happening. So please come to my Facebook page, sign the petition to set aside July 14th as a National Day of Remembrance for the victims of honor crimes. I think this is an incredible cause that we should all be involved in. As I mentioned to you, Jasmine Sanghera is here. I always say the name right, Jasvinder Sanghera. I'm so sorry about that. She's here on a campaign in the United States to bring awareness from the Honor Diaries documentary film and to create this National Day of Remembrance. I want you to hear her story from a few years ago as she takes us through the pain and horror of a forced marriage. We're going to listen to Jasvinder right now on the cross in the desert.
My name is Jasvinder Sanghera. I'm the author of Shame and Daughters of Shame. I was born in the UK and I went through the British education system, and I've lived most part of my life in Derby. My parents were Sikh. They came here in the 50s from the Punjab of India. I'm one of seven sisters, and I have to say that I'd watched the majority of my sisters being taken out of school when they were 15 years old to marry men they'd only ever met in photographs. So I knew it was going to happen somewhere along the lines, and I had one sister younger than me, so my turn was coming close when my sister above me, Rabina, was married. I was 14 when I came home from school, normal day at school, and I loved school. And my mother presented this photograph of this man who she said to me, quite jokingly, "This is the man you're going to marry." And she told me then that I was promised to him from the age of 8. And then when I was 15, they took me out of school. And I remember my father locking me in my bedroom and actually having a lock, physical lock on the door, turning the key, and not being allowed to leave until I agreed. So in the end, I said yes, because I knew that by saying yes, it would buy me time to plan an escape. I remember being in the car, and I actually ran away to Newcastle, because on the map, it was up north, and I thought, they'll never find me up there. And I remember being in the footwell of the car all the way, thinking my family are behind me. The police did find me. And thankfully, the officer believed me, and this was 28 years ago. He actually said to me he's seen this before, and that I didn't have to go back home, but I would need to ring home to say I was safe and well, and that was the deal. And I wanted my mum to say, come back, you know, that, you know, all is forgiven. You don't have to marry this man, you can finish school. In actual fact, she said to me that if I didn't come back, then I was dead in her eyes and in the eyes of the family, and that she hoped I'd give birth to a daughter and I would raise a daughter like a prostitute, because that's what I was and that's what my mother said to me. And even now, 29 years down the line, when I see my family, because I live in the same city, they crossed the road to avoid me and my children. They still haven't accepted the decision I made when I was 16. As a market trader, somebody came to my stall and said, "You need to ring home because something awful has happened." So I rang, and my mother, who I have to say was the key perpetrator in my life, it wasn't the men in my family, it was always the females that were the abusers. And my mother told me my sister Rabina, who's a year and a half older than me, had committed suicide. Rabina used to tell me when she was alive how she was suffering horrific violence in the marriage and how she couldn't leave because she would dishonour the family. But in the end, she set herself on fire and suffered 90% burns. She was 24 years old and left behind a little four-year-old boy. And I remember leaving the market store, ringing my mum, and my mother told me this. And I said to my mother, "I'm coming back to Derby now." And my mother said to me then, and this is 9 years down the line, and, you know, she'd lost the daughter in such a horrific way. My mother said to me, "Don't come to the house, you'll make it worse. You can come when it's dark and nobody can see you, and do not come to the funeral." But what angers me about today, 29 years down the line, you know, there are thousands of girls at risk and this is happening to them. And when this is happening to those girls, many British authorities, police, education, social services, turn a blind eye thinking this is part of their culture, it's what they do. It's not part of my culture to be abused by anybody. So the authorities have got to recognise and not be part of the problem in thinking there's only one, two or three of these cases. There are hundreds at risk. And we're waiting for you to ask us how we are, to intervene, to hold to account our parents, because we're too afraid to do so. I wrote Shame almost on autopilot initially, you know, and it was very difficult to write the book Shame. I have to say it was quite a cathartic process. I had to walk away from it many times, because what I was doing was unearthing stones I'd firmly put down as a coping mechanism. The survivors now that I've met through Shame have quite bravely taken a platform with me and started to break the silence. It was only ever been me, and it's really empowering for me, I have to say, and for them to be taking the platform. I've never been in a photo shoot with other survivors. It was the most empowering day in my time of doing this work, and certainly for them. And it really gave them a sense of courage and strength. And we refer to that day as a day in history for us all.
Jasvinder Sanghera, talking about the book that she wrote, Shame, chronicling the horrors of a forced marriage. She has done something so incredibly positive with her difficult experience, and she has created a foundation to bring awareness to this horrible situation. I want you to hear this brief summary of what her foundation does to help those in the same situation. Let's listen.
Thank you. My parents were Sikh, so my family's religion was Sikhism. And
I'm one of seven sisters, and the majority of us were born here in Britain. And I watched the majority of my sisters being taken out of British schools when they were 15 years old to marry men they'd only have met in photographs. They would have long absences, which were never questioned, and they would return back to the UK as somebody's wife. My sister, Rabina, was telling me how unhappy she was in her marriage. And I said to her, come to me. And she said, I can't, because I have to think about honour. She didn't want to dishonour the family by leaving her husband and divorcing him. But my sister, in the end, took her own life. She set herself on fire, Rabina did, and she died. It's more honourable to do that than to dishonour your family by leaving your husband. For me, that was a big turning point in my life. My experience and Rabina's experience, I channeled that energy into Karma Nirvana.
Good afternoon, Karma Nirvana.
Karma Nirvana is now a national charity. We are an organisation that supports victims of forced marriages and honour crimes.
Have you made any plans to go to Pakistan? Have you bought tickets or anything like that?
वो पाकिस्तान में कराची में वो खुश नहीं थी उसके साथ जो भी हुआ था वो गलत हुआ था ना.
The caller was calling on behalf of his sister, who he supported. She was a victim of, it was an arranged marriage. The man was a little bit older than her. She's experienced a lot of abuse from him. He has threatened to kill her. She was a victim of an acid attack.
Currently, we're receiving in the region of 600 calls a month. Last year, we supported 6,500 people on the helpline.
65% of our callers to our helpline are Pakistani Muslim. We also deal with Kurdish, Iranian, Somali community who again also share the Islamic faith. The other percentages are Sikh.
Feel the injustice of a 5-year-old girl in Britain today being forced into a marriage.
We are constantly going out there across the UK raising awareness amongst professionals, and we lobby Parliament.
An incredible lady from the film, the award-winning documentary film, Honor Diaries, that's Jasvinder Sangera, talking about her foundation that does such incredibly good work because of the forced marriage and the horrors and the scars that this brings. Every woman that has to go through it, her foundation is reaching out with some positive help and reinforcement. I want you to hear from Sabatina James, also of Pakistani descent, as she recalls the horrors of a forced marriage right now on the cross in the desert. Let's listen.
And my family didn't want me to adjust to the Austrian culture because for them the Western culture was evil. But I did love my genes, I did love my classmates, and I couldn't imagine why these people were bad people, you know, because in my father's view they were infidels, and I did not even drink in the same glass of water when they touched it before, you know. So I was raised in that kind of circle. And then with 16 years old, I went to Pakistan on a holiday with my parents, and they forced me to marry my cousin over there. And when I refused the marriage, they left me behind in Pakistan and said, you won't come back until you marry him. So I was sent to a Quranic madrasa there just to set me straight and to so that I break up all the Western attitudes and follow the examples of a traditional Pakistani woman. And and I came back because I had, when I agreed the marriage.
And then what gave you that, at that moment, that the courage to literally run away? I mean, you haven't seen your family since, you've been living in an assumed identity. What gave you the courage at that moment to run?
Actually, it's my faith today. I have converted from Islam to Christianity, and it's my whole motivation. I think my new faith tells me to love, and love reaches out to other people. And this is what I'm doing today. I know what a girl has to suffer when she loses everything and when the people who she loves the most are the one persecuting her. And you have to imagine, we grew up in very sheltered backgrounds, and then have this situation where we do not know how to actually live a life without your family's support. And that's in my situation, people had never heard from forced marriage when I reached out to social services, and it made it very hard for me to get help from these social workers and policemen and so on. Mm-hmm. And that's why it's so important to actually educate the society about this issue, because it's an issue that is everywhere. It's in the U.S. as well. We have a lot of forced marriage cases in America.
Yeah, we were looking at some of those numbers today, 3,000 at least, yes. And those are people who admit they were forced. As to your point, a lot of women don't admit.
Yes.
But it seems to me sort of akin to domestic violence, in that sometimes these people, the fathers, will follow the daughters and show up. Do you know this girl? Do you know this girl? Yeah. They keep looking and looking.
Yes. But, the difference between domestic violence and honor-based violence is that in the Western society, the man is the abuser, and everybody sees the man as the abuser. While in my community, the woman is the one who everybody say is the one who is committing the crime, because she has shamed the society. So people are not against the one who is the abuser, but against the women, you know. So they condemn mm-hmm. the woman for being like that and not the man. That's the huge difference between domestic violence and honor-based violence.
A very, very important point Sabatina James makes, the view of women in this culture. Men are preferred over women, sad to say, in Pakistan. It's very, very male-dominated, very, very patriarchal society. When a young girl is born to a family, a man that is born is preferred over a woman. The birth of a male versus a female. It's just that mindset of women in Pakistan. And, of course, the idea of honor. It is a holy, holy code among the family. You cannot dress a certain way. You cannot go and visit certain people without our permission. The family becomes God. The father of the family rules over everything. The choices that daughter makes, everything are in our society, we do have free will and choice. We have the opportunity to make decisions, but this is control, abuse. It is a web of terror for a woman living in Pakistan. That's why I'm writing the book, Prisoner of Her Culture, to bring awareness, just like Jasvinder and Sabatina have done through their experiences, is to educate us about the horrors, the psychological horrors, and oftentimes the honor killings resulting in forced marriage situations. We truly need to be educated and truly need to make a difference in the lives of these abused women. And again, I cannot strongly urge you enough to see the award-winning documentary film, Honor Diaries. It will truly, truly educate and change your life and help you to be a voice for these suffering women. One more report before we go on to the next subject. This is another sad tale of a woman in Pakistan right now on the cross in the desert. Let's listen.
Police say something terrible happened in a village here in the district of Bahawalpur in Pakistan's southern Punjab. A 21-year-old woman by the name of Saima Bibi is buried here. Police say her father and some relatives electrocuted her because she refused an arranged marriage and instead ran off to marry someone else. If police are right, this is what's known as an honor killing. It's when women are put to death by their families after being accused of infidelity or shameful behavior. This is the police station that's investigating Bibi's death.
She was tortured, and there were the signs of burns in the hands, on her feet, and on her back even.
This is where Bibi's body was found. It's the kitchen area at the farmhouse where they live. There's conflicting stories as to what happened. Police say late last year, Bibi, who was an ethnic Baluch, ran off to Karachi to secretly marry a fellow villager who wasn't Baluch. Police say her father and three relatives went down to Karachi and duped her into coming back. They say when she continued to reject family demands to marry a relative, she was executed.
The accused are in our custody. They are being interrogated.
Okay, we're about to meet Saima Bibi's father and her relatives who are in this jail. It's rare to get this kind of access. Now, her father has a totally different story. He says Bibi committed suicide.
She committed suicide by drinking pesticide. The moment I switched on the kitchen light, I saw her dead.
So the father says it was suicide, but police say this evidence shows he's lying.
It's a medical report that shows burn marks all over Bibi's back and neck. A recent study shows one out of five homicides in Pakistan was an honor killing. Human rights groups say a lot of people wrongly link honor killings with Islam, but they say studies show it's more of a cultural problem, most often found within Baluch communities. In a few weeks, police say Bibi's father and her relatives will be in court, where a judge will decide if she too was a victim of a so-called honor killing. Reza Sayah, CNN, Bahawalpur, Pakistan.
Such a horrifying story, but I want to add one thing, which is the motto of the film Honor Diaries. Culture is no excuse for abuse. Oftentimes we have this bifurcation between religion and culture. And while that may be debatable on one level, it still is not an excuse for abuse. You hear these horrific stories, and again, your mind wanders and thinks, well, that's all overseas. That's in the Middle East. But as I read to you in the beginning of our program, it's taking place right here before our eyes, and we need to wake up and understand that this practice is not just something in the Middle East. It's something that is happening here right before your eyes. Well, in just a couple of minutes, I'm going to have a very special guest, Naureen Anweya, who's going to update us about the genocide that is taking place in Iraq, the systematic genocide and ethnic cleansing of the Assyrian Christians. Just a few days ago, I came across a very powerful, powerful eye-opening video from a young Assyrian woman that Naureen had posted on her page, a video to raise awareness about the genocide and Christian Holocaust that's taking place in Iraq. I want to play just a couple of minutes of this. I want you to hear this woman's plea that will set up the next half of our program this morning. Let's listen.
Around the entire world, please take a picture of our genocide and speak up. Take a picture of 1915, what happened to us. ISIS was there killing all the Assyrians by the name of Jesus again, by the name of God again. But it wasn't for the name of Jesus. It wasn't for the name of God. It wasn't for anybody. It was for somebody who planned to divide the Middle East, to kill all the Christians in Middle East, to kill all the Assyrians in Middle East. So please, wake up. Wake up. Do something. John Kerry, he sold us. He sold us to ISIS in a gold plate. John Kerry, he did this. He betrayed us. John Kerry is responsible about all the genocide in Middle East now. John Kerry is the responsible man for what is happening to us now. So please, we are facing another genocide coming up. Wake up. Do something. Please, world, listen to us. Please, we are Assyrian. Help us. Nineveh is our city. Nineveh is for my grandfathers. We are still alive. We are exist. They deny the Assyrian are exist. They deny my existence. Our brothers and sisters are all over the world. We can see our brothers and sisters. Everybody is split, and we have so many people dying. We have heads hanging all over the city. Do something. This is for oil and for dollar. It's not for religion. They did this to us over and over. We have witnesses. We have evidence. We have everything. Stand with us, please, the world. If you have mercy, if you believe in God, if you believe in Jesus, if you believe in anybody, this is against my nation. What they did in Nineveh is to destroy our name and existence. It's not for religion. Believe me, it's not for religion. We know the history. We lived this before. So many times this came to us. There is an old hateness in some people to take revenge of us. And Obama didn't do anything. And the Queen Elizabeth didn't do anything. And the Rome didn't do anything. And Russia didn't do anything. And nobody wants to help us. Almania, nobody wants to help us. Who do we go to? We only have God and the good people still live on this earth. I want our youth people to come with all the pictures and evidence of what is happening to the Assyrian people and speak up and don't shut your mouth. Please stand up for your rights. We are human. We are human, and they said they're going to bring to us democracy. There is no democracy. There is nothing. We didn't see any democracy. We have been living in a nightmare since 2003, since Saddam left. We are been living in a nightmare. People are killed every day. For every cent, we pay 100 head of Assyrian people. We have been killed every day all over the world. We are all sick. We are all dying. We are all abused. And there's so many evidence. Assyrian people have been dying every day for the hateness they have. Where are you, the churches? Where are you? You talk about God. Come and help us. Come and help us. See and look at our case, what is happening. Nobody in the Congress wants to help us. Nobody in the world wants to help us. We are tired. We are tired. My country has been sold for oil and money. And people are sold for oil and money. And nobody is doing anything about this. Everybody, the whole world is silent. Everybody is scared. My nation is scared. We have no army to protect us. And we have no people to stand with us. And no, we have nobody. Only God. Only Jesus. And only the good people. Some brothers in Iraq, they stood with us. And they helped us, and they fight for the city. But there is no airplanes. There is nothing. There is no serious war against ISIS. There is no serious plan against ISIS. They only talk and speak, and they say we are waiting. Our people have been kidnapped, have been killed every day, and it's only Assyrian people, the indigenous people of this land, the indigenous of Mesopotamia, the indigenous of Babylon, the indigenous of Sumeria, the indigenous of Nineveh, the indigenous of that land. We are exist, and they call us minorities to hide our identity. We are not minorities. We are the nation of this land. We are the native. We are the indigenous. God bless you all. I hope somebody will do something. I will take a picture and show you how in 1915 they repeated this, how in 1933 they repeated this. They came target the Assyrian people in Iraq and only Assyrian people in Iraq. Nineveh is our city. They want to destroy it. They want to take our name away from that area. So there is no people exist. So they say there was no history here and this history was created by somebody else. Please understand us. Please, we need help. We need help. We need help. We need help.
And there you heard it, the pleas from an Assyrian Christian lady. The last I looked this video, it had over 6,000 hits on it. And you can understand why. If you remember back in the summer, there was a video on the internet of a young woman in the Iraqi parliament yelling and screaming, just like this lady. It's so much passion and so much hurt inside of her, yelling and screaming to help the Yazidi people who were being just systematically killed by the ISIS. They were fleeing to the mountains for safety. And so it was, I think, based on this woman in the Iraqi parliament, her plea, that a few days later, the United States began to send planes over there, airstrikes against ISIS, and also some relief to the Yazidi peoples. A lot of supplies were dropped on the mountains. But it went back to that moment in the Iraqi parliament where this young woman stood up and pleaded, "Help my people." And she was referring to the people of Iraq, the Yazidis. And in the same way, this young Assyrian lady, in the last 5 minutes, has done the best she can to lay out the case for genocide going on in Iraq. In so many ways, she is crying out in desperation for you and me to do something about this situation. And when you watch a video like that and you listen to those cries, it can't help but to break your heart. There's something very evil that is happening in Iraq. There's something horrible that is going on there simply because we haven't awakened to the real challenge of the problems that are going on there. And my next guest that I'm waiting for her to call in just a minute, Naureen Anwea, has done a tremendous amount of hard work through rallies in Chicago, through meetings with the Iraqi parliament in Michigan to bring awareness to the situation in Iraq. And now I want to welcome my very special guest all the way, I think, from Michigan today is her hometown. I want to welcome to the Cross in the Desert, Naureen and Weya. Naureen, I want to thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule. You are a Christian Assyrian human rights activist, a voice for the Assyrian Christians, and I welcome you once again to the Cross in the Desert.
Thank you so much, Randy, and we really appreciate all the awareness that you're bringing to the cause. That's extremely needed, and, you know, we will always salute you for that. Thank you.
Naureen, I don't know if you had an opportunity to just hear the audio I played from that poor Assyrian Christian woman pleading with the world to do something about the genocide that's going on there. I know that it was on your Facebook page. Such a powerful video. I listen to it, and then I think of what today is. Today is April 16th. It is National Holocaust Remembrance Day. When we look back to the atrocities committed against the Jewish people, over 6 million gassed and murdered by Germany. Now, I'm going to ask you, in contrast to that, Naureen, are we looking at something similar going on in Iraq with the Assyrians?
Absolutely, and on this very special day, you know, I would like to say I stand with my Jewish brothers and sisters who were victims to the Holocaust, that the entire world stood silent, and we completely know how they feel and how they still feel as the world stands, the world leaders stand silent while the Assyrian Christians and our fellow minorities, such as the Yazidis, are facing another genocide. And, you know, we are not receiving any substantial help. And like she said in the video, which completely devastated me to watch, and this is how many of our people in Iraq and Syria feel, that there is no serious war against ISIS and that they are extremely funded. And, you know, there's nothing serious that's being done to destroy them. So the people will never live in peace for as long as ISIS exists. And they're constantly recruiting people on a monthly basis. And how are they supposed to live? How are they supposed to have any hope? And what devastates me even more is that many of these people are losing hope. They truly are. Some have committed suicide. Some, you know, they're losing their children in their arms. A mother messaged me. She was able to get to, you know, a social media, and she messaged me and said, I lost my child in my arms to a virus they extracted from the camps. And these are messages I always receive, that they're dying in their arms. They don't have any medications. They're, you know, even the NGOs are running out of resources. You know, there's only so much an NGO can do for over 6 million displaced people that, you know, the world governments are ignoring. And, you know, we're very thankful there are some churches there, American churches that came, but, you know, even with them, how much can they possibly do? You know, they're exhausting as much as they can, but the crisis is so intense that we truly need, first of all, for ISIS to be removed.
Yes. I was sitting here thinking, Naureen, as you laid out the case for the atrocities that are going on there, many of the waking world wasn't aware of what was going on with Germany exterminating the Jews. When the soldiers marched into the camp, they were horrified. There wasn't this worldwide awareness that was quite hidden quite well, and the Germans would burn their gas chambers and things to hide their crimes. But here the world can look on the news and look on the internet and see what's happening to the Assyrian Christians. We have a responsibility. We are aware to do something about this crisis. We have the watching world seeing what's going on.
Yes, thank you, Randy. And what also really drives me off the wall is that they're destroying our artifacts. So this plan is very strategically put together, because not only have they detonated almost every single Assyrian, Chaldean, and Syriac churches, which are all of our segregations of our nation and our churches, they've detonated over 120 churches. And now they have gone to our historical landmarks, like the city of Nimrod and, you know, the walls of Nineveh. There's all of our artifacts in one of the oldest museums in the world, in Mosul. All of our artifacts are being destroyed. You know, they're specifically targeting us to remove us from there, a fertile crescent, a land rich in oil and uranium. Jeremy, this is definitely religious. It's ethnic and extremely political. There are many nations that are involved with ISIS, and this is where we need to hold them accountable. You know, there were hundreds of vehicles being imported into Iraq from Turkey. How did all the world leaders miss that? How did the regional, the central, national government miss all of that? You know, this was planned years ago. And, you know, it just surprises me that our human lives are being sold. And this needs to end. You know, this truly needs to end because this is not going to get anywhere. You know, we're creating a monster that's going to backfire and it's going to hurt us much worse. And Christianity is being annihilated, Randy, in the Middle East, not just in Iraq. And no one is doing anything substantial about it.
This is frightening, and I'm sitting here and I'm listening to what you're saying, and my heart just breaks because this is the cradle of Christian civilization. Like you mentioned, the biblical artifacts are being destroyed. This is a plan. This is not just some hapstance. This is something planned. Now, recently you had a guest from the Iraqi parliament. His name is Rabbi Yonadam. You call him Rabbi. And he had come to Michigan, and there was a conference there, and he was on the Sean Hannity show not too long ago. What kind of perspective does Rabbi Yonadam bring to the crisis? He's an Iraqi parliament member. He's a Christian. What are the things that he has shared that can make a difference and bring awareness to us that we can do something?
He has been fighting for us for many, many years, and he's the Secretary General of the Assyrian Democratic Movement, besides being our Iraqi parliament member. And he is voicing our cry, not only in Iraq, but as well in the United States, who he actually mentions to be his dear friend and his second home. And he just constantly, you know, advocates for us, and he's trying to put in many different political and, you know, legal actions to help us. And as the indigenous people that the government in Iraq fails to acknowledge. And, you know, he just works every day. He barely gets any sleep, and he tries to give us hope, you know, that we constantly have to keep working. We have to keep lobbying. We have to keep spreading awareness as much as possible, because even he understands that this, you know, ISIS issue is a global issue. He had mentioned that it is a local conflict, it's a regional conflict, it's a national conflict, and a global conflict. There are many things that are involved in this. It is bigger than we even know. And, you know, it's definitely, you know, religious, it's ethnic, but it is extremely, extremely, and when I mean political, it is very political as well. And that's where, you know, the good people, just like the woman said in the video, must stand up and say that we do not allow this, we do not accept this. You know, there are more good people in the world than bad people, and we will stand against this community, and we never want another genocide to take place. And he also fights for a internationally protected safe haven for not only the Christians, but as well as the fellow minorities that are extremely suffering this genocide. And, you know, we definitely need that. Without a safe haven, we cannot exist any longer. We will be extinct, Randy. And I promise that no one will ever hear about Assyrians ever again, but only in history books. And we also need international support for our freedom fighters, our fighters in the units of the NPU, the Ninwa Plains Protection Units. We need our own units, our fighting units, who will never abandon us, who will never drop their weapons and leave if there's an invasion by another terrorist organization. You know, I'm not sure, but I believe a lot of people in the world think that Iraq was bombarded by thousands and thousands of terrorists. Iraq was invaded with less than 1,000 ISIS terrorists that took over a large portion of Iraq. How is that possible? How did this happen? There were sleeping cells in the country. There were over 10,000 terrorists waiting, and they were planning for years. And how did the, you know, how did the world miss that again? You know, for such a large terrorist organization to be planting in an area where innocent Christians and, you know, Yazidis lived and had no protection. You know, some of the areas, they actually had no combat at all. They were just forced to evacuate, and their lands were easily taken that way. You know, and these are, Randy, we have never been evacuated off of Nineveh. We have never left our indigenous lands in thousands and thousands of years since our ancient ancestors. This is the first time ever that even since the beginning of Christianity, there's no mass there. Our people are so scared to even pray. They're scared to be targeted. You know, they're afraid to voice their cries. Even on the phone, it's so hard to get because they're afraid they're being listened to. You know, they don't know who to trust anymore.
Understandable. Now, I keep going back to this point. I've listened to the presentation you've given me. You've laid out the facts. They're undeniable. They're before our eyes. And yet this vacuum was created when Obama removed our troops from Iraq, one of the greatest mistakes we have ever made, to allow this presence of our troops there, allowed this vacuum, these sleeper cells and these terrorists to engage and to take over many of the areas in Iraq. One of the greatest mistakes, Noreen, wouldn't you agree?
Yes, absolutely. And the moment he did, you know, that's when they were heavily formed and created in these sleeping cells. This is how they attacked. They first formed sleeping cells, you know, and we should be afraid of that. Sleeping cells could be formed not only in the Middle East, but anywhere in the world. And this is how they start. It's a matter of one sleeping cell leading to 300, 400, 200, depending on the size of the country. And him removing our soldiers, and I spoke to some of the soldiers that were forcefully removed from Iraq when they've shed their blood and sweat into the country to free it. And they were amazed. They were surprised. They couldn't believe that their missions were cut short. Some of them were not even halfway in their mission. So they were very afraid. They told me they knew this was going to happen. They knew something like this was going to happen, you know, having the borders wide open. And the soldiers, the Iraqi soldiers, were not even completely fully trained yet. So when you're, you know, being attacked by this ISIS militia, we don't even know who's behind them. There's millions and millions of dollars behind them. They're trained with tactics that some of our, you know, some of the military units don't even know about. They're so, you know, advanced. And, you know, that was a big mistake. And we're the people are the ones that are paying for it. You know, the children who were kidnapped and they're being sold into sex slavery as young as 3 years old.
It's just horrible. I'm thinking of the huge political menangling and the mistakes that we have made to put the people of Iraq at such great risk. And now we're reaping what we have sown. You know, I want to know, through all of your hard work and your awareness and your political rallies that you've had, you just came back from celebrating, I think, the Assyrian New Year in Australia. You have been tirelessly working. What kind of response are you getting from our government? Is your voice, do you think, is being heard at all through all of your hard work?
I believe it's been heard. As far as are they going to do something about it now, I hope so. I pray so. Even though I don't want to say that I don't think they will do something about it right this moment, because I don't want our people in the Middle East listening to lose hope, but I truly believe that we are on the right track. I also believe in someone that's greater than everything and everyone in this world, and that is our Almighty God. I believe that his prophecies are coming true. I believe that the people of Nineveh will rise. And, you know, our lands will not be completely destroyed. You know, it could take one tribe to rebuild an entire nation again. And I believe that these things that are happening, God will spare us and he will help us. And, you know, I'm seeing a lot of the things that are happening. They're in the Bible. And, you know, I don't want our people to lose hope. But I just wish that our administration, our current administration right now, takes this matter more serious. I want to see, as Hillary Clinton claims to be a humanitarian hero, I want her involved in the humanitarian crisis that's happening right now in Iraq that even the UN can't even barely handle. You know, this is an extreme, extreme humanitarian need. NGOs can't do this alone. And, you know, our president, I can confirm that is not taking ISIS very seriously. And, you know, this will continue to grow for as long as we have an administration like this that is not taking any of this seriously. And they're not even acknowledging us by our ethnic name. You know, he's acknowledging the Shias and the Sunnis and actually acknowledged us as ancient people. However, we have a title. We have a title that's almost 7,000 years old. You know, we are Assyrians. We're in history books. We're in the Bible. You know, we're not just ancient people as he named us on, you know, his opening statements.
Yes, I'm going to ask you a couple questions relevant to just what you pointed out to us. Number one is that hope is being crushed through all of the evil and suffering that's happening there. The people, the Assyrian people, their hope is being dashed. It's being crushed. As a Christian, when you see the evil and the suffering on such a massive scale, does that help? What does that do to your Christian faith? Does that shake your Christian faith? Does that make things difficult for you? How do you cope with that when you see all the evil and suffering as a Christian?
Honestly, I just get closer to God. I feel him in my heart every day, and I always hear him tell me, you know, to not give up and to keep going, and that, you know, he really makes me aware that there's a greater plan out there, that something good out of all this horrible things that are happening to our people, that something great will come out of this. And, you know, it definitely tears me apart and breaks my heart. You know, there are nights that I don't get any sleep, but I do believe that our amazing God has something, you know, in plan for us. And, you know, all this suffering will not go in vain. And, you know, just not our people there, but our fellow Americans that lost their lives in these wars will not go in vain. And, you know, it's a city, it's a historical area that's been around for thousands of years, and not even ISIS can destroy it, or anyone behind it will ever tear it apart, because this city can be harmed. We can be slaughtered. We can be raped and kidnapped, but no one will ever destroy our faith and our relationship with God.
Yes, and you reminded me, Noreen, how sovereign God is. That there is a purpose in the suffering and the evil. We think of the early Christian church, the martyrs that died, and look how the church grew and has impacted the world since the first century. That God has a plan and a purpose, even in the most graphic of evil and suffering, that he truly is in control. And our faith is strengthened. It's not destroyed. Even though we see this happening before our eyes, we can be strengthened and we can be assured that God has a plan and a purpose, but that it involves all of us. We don't sit idly by and just look at it. I wanted to ask you about the presidential candidates, specifically the Republicans, Rand Paul, Ted Cruz, Marco Rubio. We need a tough administration in 2017. Not unlike the one we have here, that's going to take terrorism seriously, that is going to be strong in the foreign policy area. After listening to some of the candidates, who do you look to, do you think, that is going to be strong and tough on terrorism and will take up this call for the Assyrians in a more serious way? Is there any one particular person you're looking at that impresses you that way?
Honestly, I normally like to listen to their debates, and I want to hear how they communicate with each other and what they actually have to offer us. But, you know, I do like a lot of the things that Mr. Ted Cruz has said from Texas.
Yes.
You know, I admire Mr. Rick Snyder. I also believe that, you know, Mr. Jeb Bush would also be a good candidate. But it's really hard to tell at this moment, until we actually see them in full motion, and that would be the best time to actually pick someone that I will stand behind 100% and only him, instead of decide between a few. But I believe that as we're deciding for the next leader of our American nation is to vote for someone who is not ashamed to be American, who's proud and proud to be American, and will scream it in someone's face. and that will not destroy our military units within, someone that will help grow our military. And, you know, I just feel that sometimes we have presidents that try to destroy our country within, and there are many people that have witnessed and seen this, and so therefore we need someone who's patriotic, someone who's proud of their faith, regardless of what religion they are. They must be proud instead of hide behind a faith that they are not.
This is very excellent, the points that you bring out, and I agree we need to look at the debates and see what they have to say, and I agree with you on Ted Cruz is very strong. I think he would be a good leader. He's patriotic. He loves his country. He's not apologizing every time you turn around for his country. I think he would be a good, strong leader, but I'm with you. I want to watch the debates as well. We've covered a lot of ground here today. We've talked about the situation. We talked about the need for involvement. We've talked about how it impacts us as Christians and how we look at this. What ways can my listeners who listen to this program, what particular ways can they get involved to reach out to the Assyrian people? I think you mentioned some of those ways before, but let's talk about them again, because action is so important. More than just words and more than just awareness, we need to be active as Christians to reach out to our brothers and sisters who are suffering so much.
Absolutely. Thank you. And truly, our American brothers and sisters, and you know, through their awareness and their involvement, just as good people, regardless of what field they are, stepped up and tried to make a difference in helping us. And, you know, I get contacted by my American brothers and sisters all the time, you know, in different fields they're in, and asking how they can help, regardless of how the administration has handled it. One really big thing they can do is call the White House. Let them know that they're aware that Assyrians still exist. They're aware that Christianity still exists in Iraq and Syria, and that they need to implement an emergency solution right now. We cannot afford to wait 6 more months or 1 more year or 2 more years. You know, we will appreciate a solution when it happens, but truly we will be harmed much more than we are right now if we're going to wait another year, because people are dying slowly. They're being purged out even more. They're being displaced throughout the Middle East. They have no food. You know, they're not really getting any support from the countries they're going to, because they're refugees. They can't even get a job. So they're suffering there too, even though they have their life. But they're being purged off of their native lands, and they truly want to remain home. So they can call them and tell them that we want you to support the Assyrians, the indigenous people of Iraq, the natives of Iraq. We're constantly funding the Kurds and the central government, which we are not telling our administration to stop funding, but we need them to direct the aid to the Christians and the Yazidis, the two minorities that are labeled as minorities, but we are the only two that have lived there longer than anyone there. We've been there for thousands of years, almost 7,000 years. Assyrians have inhabited those lands, tracing back to ancient Assyria and Mesopotamia and Babylon. But we need to address it firmly with them. And, you know, we need them to keep calling their Congress people to ask them that, you know, why, where are our tax dollars going to? Who are they funding exactly? Why don't we actually start funding the correct group? You know, why don't we start supporting Christians for once in the Middle East when they're being annihilated? You know, our funding is constantly, you know, a lot of it is going to the different governments in Iraq, but they're not seeing direct help. You know, the NGOs are trying to help and the UN, but where is the help from the government itself? Why do we have to do something ourselves to help them only? You know, there's millions and billions of dollars being produced in oil revenue, you know, and they just need direct. I had mentioned to them that we need a direct port directly to the Christians and the Yazidis, that we don't need a middleman, because this is how we are not receiving help. This is how we have come down to less than 500,000 in Iraq. In 2003, there were over 1.5 million Assyrians. Now we're down to less than 500,000. Now we've decreased to not even 3 million in the whole world. We used to be over 30 million at the last census that the Assyrians had recorded. We created the census. You know, all of these things that, you know, the cradlers of civilization, and we don't even have a nation. We don't even have an area where we can call home, where we can save our ethnicity, our Aramaic language, our old Christian faith. You know, these are the things that our government is failing to acknowledge. Sometimes they're making decisions and they don't even know the history of that country. You know, they don't even realize that the indigenous, the native people are being annihilated. Maybe they can implement a law in Iraq how we protect the Native Americans in our country, in the United States.
Right.
They need to do that. If they're not going to grant us an internationally protected safe haven, we need those rights in Iraq. And honestly, I don't even believe that they will fully abide by these indigenous laws unless we have our own internationally protected safe haven. That is the only way to save Assyrians.
Yes, there's a lot of work to be done. There's no excuse for this negligence. We need to reach out to the Assyrian people. You mentioned, most importantly, call the White House. What about a practical way also, as far as an organization where I can help financially, can reach out in that way to help?
Yes, there are a few NGOs that are working tirelessly, and they're actually, they always mention that they come so close to running out of money, and when they do, these people are not going to be fed and they're not going to get any help. And that is an amazing, amazing organization, is AssyrianAid.org. They have been there for years, and they are working on the ground, hands-on, with these internally displaced people. But that is www.AssyrianAid.org. And, you know, we really appreciate any kind of help that our fellow brothers and sisters can give. And also there's another one. It is called theassero.org. That's theassero.org. And The Assyrio is the Church of the East organization. And they're also working with the internally displaced people. And, you know, they try to group together just vital necessities in a bag. And, you know, they're trying to hand out hundreds and hundreds of bags to thousands of people. So sometimes they do run out of resources and the bags get shortened and these people come to collect from these camps and they don't have enough food to give their children. You know, some of these families might have five children, and, you know, a lot of, unfortunately, we did lose quite a few seniors that passed away because they couldn't survive the conditions, and also babies. We lost a lot of babies and children who were not getting, like, their, you know, milk and their formulas, and they were slowly dying. So some of the people that are, you know, trying to survive this and they've made it are, you know, the healthy, only the super healthy and strong that can actually live in these types of conditions of living in a camp, living through the winter, you know, in this type of weather that you and I, you know, can maybe run to the car in a coat and quickly get in a car. You know, I live in Michigan. It's extremely cold in northern Iraq. It gets very, very cold. Not as brutally cold as Michigan, but it gets pretty, you know, up there. It snows. It snows there. So, you know, we tried as hard as we can to get them in, you know, out of these camps and these tents, but there's just so many of them, and a lot of them are in unfinished buildings, and there's no windows, and they were snowed on and rained on, and, you know, they're suffering immensely as they're waiting for the administrations of not only Iraq or the United States, but of the world, for some leader with a big heart to act substantially against ISIS and, you know, grant them an area where they can be safe.
Yes, you really paint the picture so well. You really made me very aware of the depth of suffering that's going on. You've made such a very powerful case, Noreen, and we can get involved in so many ways. AssyrianAid.org, call the White House, get involved in reaching out to these people. You know, Noreen, I don't want another Holocaust. This is Holocaust Remembrance Day. This is a wake-up call, and we need to remember from the errors of history, from the neglect of history. We don't want another Holocaust. I want to thank you so much for bringing this information
to us. Thank you, Randy.
And and educating us. And I wish you well. I pray for you. I pray for the Assyrian people that there will be answers and relief very, very soon.
Thank you very much, and we really appreciate everything you're doing. And, you know, it is truly the people that are going to help us through this. And, you know, I forgot to mention to you that, unfortunately, there are lobbyists in the White House from other countries that are being paid millions of dollars to lobby against our cause. And that is something I want our fellow Americans to know as well, that, you know, they're lobbying against the Christians of Iraq and to, you know, for their own personal agendas.
It's just horrible. The way politics and the corruption of politics, Noreen, is ruling the world, it's going to take good, hardworking, patriotic Americans that have a big heart and that will reach out with the Assyrians, and we'll make a difference. We can't depend on governments. We can't look to governments. Our God will provide a safe haven, a safe place for the Assyrians, a safe highway. If we look to governments, we're going to be disappointed, but I'm glad that you're leading this cause as a strong voice and a faithful Christian. I want to thank you so much for coming
on
the Cross in the Desert.
God bless you, and God bless all of my fellow Christian brothers and sisters and our fellow Americans in, you know, helping us.
God bless you too, Noreen. You're always welcome back here as a guest on the Cross in the Desert. We are going to keep this page filled with notices about the Assyrians. God bless you, dear.
God bless you too, Rainy. Bye-bye.
That is a very courageous, passionate lady, Noreen Anweya, just a wonderful friend. And I'm going to make sure that my Facebook page is always updated with what's going on in Iraq about the Assyrian Christians, because I know that you, my listeners, are going to make a difference in the cause for these Assyrian people. We don't want another genocide. We don't want another Holocaust. We can do nothing more. If we stand by and do nothing, evil will triumph. But once we put our hands to the plow, and through the grace of God, we will make a difference in the lives of these Assyrian Christians. I know we will. There'll be postings on my page about AssyrianAid.org. I'll make sure that you can connect with them. And you can call the White House, too, and get involved and be a voice for the Assyrian Christians who are suffering. In this last half of The Cross in the Desert, I want to focus in on a musician, a guitarist and a keyboard player that had such an impact on my life. And his name is Kerry Livgren. He was the songwriter, the keyboard player, and the guitarist from the phenomenal group Kansas. At some point in his musical journey, he decided he needed to know answers for life, and he was on a journey to discover who God was. And we're going to listen in on behind the scenes from a movie he made called The Imposter as he shared his testimony. But I think one of the songs you can never forget is a song that really launched Kansas into fame. It's a song called Carry On My Wayward Son. We're going to listen to it right now. Here's Kansas on the Cross in the Desert.
Carry on my wayward son, there'll be peace when you are done. Lay your weary head to rest, don't you cry no more.
Carry on.
very powerful song from Left Overture. That was the LP that launched Kansas into their fame as the group Kansas, Carry On My Wayward Son. But it reflected also a troubled person, a person searching for answers. And we're going to listen to Carrie describe his spiritual journey right now as he sat down on the set of the movie The Imposter and shared how he came to know Christ. Let's listen right now on The Cross in the Desert.
Carrie.
Carry On Wayward Son, I guess it's a little bit autobiographical. I saw myself as, I'm not there yet. Something, I just need to keep searching, and eventually, you know, the last line of the song is, surely heaven waits for you. I didn't know how to get there, how to find it. But I knew that I just had to keep, you know, being the pilgrim. I was 9 years old. Both of my grandmothers and our family's best friend all died the same week. So at the age of 9, and of course kids think they're eternal, you know, dying is something that happens to people on TV. And suddenly I was confronted with grieving and weeping and death of some people that I loved. And I really think that instilled in me, way in the back of my mind, a drive to find out what it's all about. I want to know what happened to my grandmothers. I want to know what's going to happen to me. What does my life mean? So when I was in high school, I had a very small peer group, because when everybody was chasing girls and playing football and stuff, we were reading Nietzsche and Kant and sitting around talking about the great philosophers and stuff. Really, just because I was interested in eternity. So with that in mind, I kind of set a goal in my life, and I had these two parallel goals. One was to make it big as a rock star, and the other was find out what life's all, and the meaning of life, you know. Those two are a little bit diametrically opposed. So the dream of being a rock star slowly, very slowly, began to come true, and it kind of took precedence, and I got all caught up in that experience. And for a young guy to get to a point where everything that this world tells you you go after, money, fame, fortune, success, girls, it was all handed to us on a platter. And that was an incredibly destructive thing. It was not at all, I mean, a huge bubble popped. And it created a crisis where my other goal suddenly came to the forefront. And that was reflected in my music. Some of the guys in the band tried to fill that void with drugs or you know, partying, having fun, whatever. And but me, it drove me deeper into my quest. I carried around a suitcase that the roadies affectionately called the library. It was full of books. It must have weighed 150 pounds. Every kind of religious book you could imagine. I went through all the major religions of the world, all the minor ones. I was scraping the bottom of the barrel. I was into religions nobody ever heard of. The last one I was into was one called Urantia, based on a book called the Urantia Book. I never met another Urantian. As far as I knew, I was the only one. I really would like to have met another one, and then there would have been two of us, you know. And I actually got kind of evangelical about that. And the interesting irony is that the central figure in the Urantia Book was Jesus. So I'd gone completely full circle. I came back around. But I got to tell you, I did not want to become a Christian. What I saw of Christians and Christianity was well, mostly TV preachers. I had a very skeptical view of Christianity. And we happened to meet up with another band that was, they were our opening act, called Louisiana's LaRue. And their lead guitar player had long blonde hair. I had long blonde hair. He was a lead player. I was a lead player. I was the main songwriter. He was the main songwriter. We hit it off right away. Well, then I found out he was deeply into spiritual things. And much to my disappointment, I found out he was a Christian. So I thought, all right, I'm going to talk to this guy, and I'm going to make Urantian number two out of this guy. You know, so we started having these kind of theological debates. And I became so obsessed with that because he sat down with his Bible, and we would go back and forth. I had my Urantia book open. I actually gave up my seat on our private plane we had chartered to ride on their bus. They had made a partition in their bus. They had actually put up a plywood partition in the back of the bus that was the Christian section. They put him back there, and in the front there was wild partying going on, you know. So I'm sitting in the back of this bus, and he's reading to me stuff out of the Bible. And there was this curious phenomenon. I'm a pretty good debater, pretty good arguer. I usually win arguments. And so I'm debating with him. But when he read me something out of the Bible, it was like he was sticking a dagger in my heart. And it began to eat away at me. And way down somewhere, I knew this was truth. And I tell people the experience was like if you're in a barrel and you're going down the Niagara River, and you're out in the middle of the river, and the falls is coming up, and you can hear the roar, you can feel the spray, and you know you're going over it, but you don't want to, but you can't fight the current. Well, that's what it felt like. I was coming toward this huge event that I really didn't want to happen. So we split up. He gave me a Bible and a little book by Hal Lindsey called The Liberation of Planet Earth, and I stuck them in my suitcase full of books, and I really didn't want to cope with it. But maybe a couple of weeks went by, and I finally thought, you know, something's got to happen here. Something's got to give. And one night at 3 o'clock in the morning after a concert in Indianapolis, Indiana, I was in a hotel room by myself, and I got this little Hal Lindsey book out. And it's basically a pretty clever little gospel tract, you know, dressed up as a book on a different subject. And I was kind of skimming through it, and I, you know, he had these little diagrams of what Jesus, what he did on the cross actually meant, who he actually was. And it got to the part where, Hal Lindsey said something like, if he was actually raised from the dead, what does that mean? That means he's alive right now as you're reading this. And that hit me like a train. And I guess what happened, I kind of surrendered. You know, I'd been searching for God so long, I was weary. Didn't want to be a Christian, but I said, I got on my knees and I surrendered and I said, if this is true, then I don't care if I don't like it. I want the truth. And at that moment, I became somebody different. Totally, totally changed me. Fulfilled. I knew everything I'd ever been looking for had been found. And that was 20-some years ago. And still sitting here talking about it.
He's an incredible Christian and as well a credible, incredible musician. I remember growing up on the music of Kansas. I was always so fascinated by a lot of their songs. One of them was called The Wall from Left Overture. And it was the story of a man trying to break through the wall surrounding his life, trying to make sense of his life, but there's this wall. And that really is Carey's testimony. He wrote a book with Kenneth Boa called Seeds of Change. He outlines why he wrote certain songs in Kansas, what they meant at that time. He chronicles his spiritual quest. It really is an incredible book, and my dream is to have Carey as a guest on the radio program where he can actually interact with you. You can call in and ask him questions and go into more detail about his spiritual journey, because believe me, There was a song right before I became a Christian that really, really touched my heart and soul. And that was a song called Dust in the Wind, which we're going to end with today. Because it's a song about our humanity, our short term here on the earth. Just like the Bible says, our life is like a vapor. Dust in the Wind kind of asks the question, are we all just nothing more than dust in the wind? Is life really full of purpose and meaning, or is it meaningless? It sounds like when Carey wrote that, he was reading the book of Ecclesiastes, but he talks about how Dust in the Wind was based on a Native American poem. But this song has created in so many people a spiritual search, because you think about our life, our mortality, all we are is dust in the wind. Not another moment will your money buy. And it really begins that search in us. And I think it's probably one of the most incredible songs ever written. It's such a simple song in one sense, but such a powerful song in the other sense. Well, as you listen to Carey talk about how a faithful Christian shared the Word of God with him on a bus one night, gave him a book, and how it changed his life forever, what about you? What about your spiritual search? Do you see life as meaningless, or do you see life full of purpose? Do you believe there is a God that created us for purpose and meaning? Would you like to know him? Maybe you are like Carey. You've searched all the major and minor religions of the world, and still you're coming up empty. Did you know that 2,000 years ago, Jesus died on a cross to bridge the gap between us and a holy God? He laid down his life and took all of our sin and debt so that we could find our purpose in life, our forgiveness and restoration with God, so that your life can have meaning and purpose when you connect with the one who made this possible, and that is Jesus. He's not just a good man, a good prophet, or a good teacher. He is God. He has come to us as God. He has put on human flesh. He lived among us. He taught. He did miracles. He healed. He showed compassion and love. And then one day he said, I'm going to make your life full of meaning and purpose. I'm going to show you beyond any doubt who I am. And the world was appalled that this man who claimed to be God would lay his life down on a wooden tree for forgiveness of our sins. But you see, that's the answer to our problem. Not just our praying and fasting and good deeds. We're still empty. But what makes it life all worth living is that we know we're forgiven, that we have a relationship with God now, that we have eternal life. And that is a gift that God has given us in Jesus Christ. So like Carey, take a moment, listen to what the Word of God says, read a book, and you will discover that you're more than just dust in the wind, that you have a meaning and purpose created by a holy God. He wants you to know him in such an intimate way. I want to thank you so much for being with me today on The Cross in the Desert, listening to the powerful interview about forced marriage, Naureen and Wea, and her powerful case for the Assyrian Christians. What I want to do right now is I want to leave you with a song that asked this question that Carey was confronted of. He was the songwriter of this song, Dust in the Wind. And as you listen to the lyrics, if you're not a Christian, if you're searching, if you're one of these people like Carey, then at the end of this song, think about who Jesus is and find out that you're truly more dust in the wind. I will see you on Monday. God bless you. Have a powerful and important weekend. Bye till then.